The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello all, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. If you've been on the internet at all, ever, you've probably noticed that you can't believe everything you find there. You have your 9/11 truthers, the moon hoaxers, climate change denialists, the Discovery Institute, and pretty much any dating site. But there's also the alternative health claims of miracle cures for everything from colic to cancer. And while the former are amusing mostly, the latter can be costly and dangerous. Today we'll be joined by Brent Homan of the Canadian Competition Bureau to talk about health fraud on and off the internet. But first, I have a brief announcement from the British Columbia Skeptics. On November 27th, legendary actor and outspoken skeptic William B. Davis, famous for portraying one of the most recognizable villains of all time, the cigarette-smoking man in The X-Files, debates Professor Richard Dawkins' criticism of the show. Did it really undermine rational thought and promote pseudoscience? The Center for Inquiry Vancouver is hosting this event, and if you'd like more information, go to centerforinquiry.net/Vancouver/events. And speaking up segment today is about a new spin on an old favorite. We have Brian Gregory on the line to talk about his new project, Virtual Drinking Skeptically. Brian's a software architect whose career has grown up on the internet. He's been skeptically minded for most of his life, but like a lot of people, has only recently discovered the movement. He considers himself a walking example of why people need to be taught the difference between rationalization and being rational. He also likes long walks on the beach.
Certainly.
Thanks, Brian. So tell us about what you're doing.
Well, I mean, a lot of your listeners probably have heard of Skeptics in the Pub or Drinking Skeptically, which are, I mean, networks of local skeptical social groups. They're all over the United States. They're all over the world. I know Skeptics in the Pub is mentioned regularly on some of the podcasts that we all listen to. Mm-hmm. They are pretty much they're social events where people can go, skeptical people, like-minded, critical thinkers, and fellowship, network, hangout, act goofy, and the like. We pretty much just take that same idea and try to do it online.
So we attended last week, the whole Skeptically Speaking team.
Yes, and
by attended, I mean totally crashed your party and forced you to deal with multiple technical issues instead of actual conversation. You're welcome.
Thank you.
we had six people on one screen, so there's obviously bound to be problems. But regardless, what we were able to hear and see and participate in sounded very fun, actually.
We usually do have quite a bit of fun. I mean, we do... probably a little bit more than some of the groups I've attended go to. I mean, we're all geeks. Most of us have met on social media like Twitter or Facebook. We spend most of the time fooling around. We also communicate, network, talk about what's going on in the news, skeptical topics, anything from the latest H1N1 news to what events are going on, who we've met, you know, because we're all, you know, fans as well. The biggest problems we have, I mean, it works well. The software, not quite there yet, but it works well enough. The tools we're using right now, there are free multi-video web chat sites. There's a couple of them we've tried. We usually get, you know, 6 to 8 people, maybe some more, and we end up talking most of the night.
And actually, the operative word here, people, is free.
Yes.
One of the things about drinking skeptically, or skeptics in the pub, whatever the case may be, is that you usually do have to buy your own drinks there.
So yeah,
you can participate in the comfort of your own home. But one of the other nice thing about this actually is that you get to meet skeptics that are not in your local community. Even if you actually are lucky enough to have a skeptical community close by or where you live, that's lovely. But these are all people that are not even necessarily in your time zone.
Yeah, this is one of the things that I really love about doing this group is that I get to meet people from all over the country and all over the world. We've had people from Australia show up one evening when we went very, very late. But I mean, I love meeting people I haven't met before, people with different points of view, people who have different cultures they live in. So, I mean, and I'm a talker, so I got a selfish mode, so.
So what kind of discussions have you had so far? What are some of the highlights?
Well, there because we feed the group a lot from Twitter, there is quite a few atheists that show up. We do have a lot of talks about what's going on in the United States with atheism. We also exchange funny video clips, like the latest Mr. Deity. Let's see, last time we had a nice conversation about what was Young Ones.
Brilliant.
The number of Young Ones fans in the group. So
I wonder, is that a skeptical thing?
I don't know. Well, I mean,
I own the box set. I just like
to
find out.
Yeah, I do too.
Okay.
It's awesome.
There is some overlap. So how important is alcohol to virtual drinking skeptically? Like, are non-drinkers going to be welcome? Because when we were there, although our sound was off half the time and we're dealing with all those technical issues, it didn't seem like anybody was smashed, which is lovely.
Yeah, actually, last week, I was a teetotaler. I was drinking water the whole time. So you don't have to drink, although it's nice that you don't have to drive anywhere afterwards. So anybody
yet another selling
free
feature
to get comfortable.
Perfect. So who's your target audience here? Who do you think should be coming out to virtual drinking skeptically?
Well, pretty much anybody that I'd like to meet. But, we have a wide range. We have both young and old. We have both hardcore skeptics and some of the milder skeptics, people that talk a lot, people who don't talk a lot. We have all the gamut. So pretty much every week the group changes. We have regulars, people who like the concept, and we talk a lot on people who like to talk a lot from Twitter. And then we have people that show up from time to time that they have other things to do. There's really not much commitment you have to have to the group. And also it's a video chat, but you're not required to use the camera. We also have the tools support just audio, and they also have a text chat. So people aren't comfortable with jumping in, or they don't have the computer that supports the video, or whatever. You can just come check it out. You can see the video streams. If you're not interested, that's up to you.
Perfect. So where can people find out more about virtual drinking skeptically?
Well, I have a blog, virtualds at WordPress. You can also, there's a Facebook group for Virtual Drinking Skeptically. There's also a Twitter that you can follow, VirtualDS, or you can follow me if you want to get an outrageously large amount of tweets.
You are a high-volume tweeter, sir.
Yes, I am. It's an addiction. I'm sorry.
We don't judge.
Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being here, Brian. And thank you for setting this all up.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this is a great opportunity for people to get to know other people outside of their own skeptical communities. To I was actually thinking last night, for people that are disabled in any way and are housebound for a short period, perhaps they have the H1N1 flu. This is a good way to get your skeptical fix without leaving your house at all.
Absolutely. And some of us have families too, which is another reason why we would be in the house. So
absolutely. So we will be back, but probably not all of us at the same time. We were rather intrusive.
Mm-hmm. We have one tonight at 9 Eastern time. I guess it's shortly after your show ends. So anybody who wants to join us tonight, we're going to be chatting it up and having fun.
Perfect. So everyone hear that. If you are not going out tonight, you have some place to go. Virtually. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
And if anyone out there is interested in appearing on Speaking Up to talk about a new event or a project, or just to share some information about a favorite skeptical or science topic, do head to the website at skepticallyspeaking.com and visit the Speaking Up page. We'll be right back with Brent Homan from the Canadian Competition Bureau right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking also airs on Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're talking today with Brent Homan from the Canadian Competition Bureau about health fraud. Brent is currently an Assistant Deputy Commissioner of Competition for the Fair Business Practices branch of the Competition Bureau, and is partially responsible for the Competition Bureau's misleading advertising program. He joined the Bureau in 1999 with the Mergers Branch, taking a senior position with the Fair Business Practice Branch in 2002 to lead misleading advertising investigations in the areas of price representations, e-commerce, and health fraud. He spearheaded Project FairWeb, an award-winning enforcement program aimed at combating misleading representations found on the Internet. Further, Mr. Homan led the tobacco inquiry into the use of light and mild descriptors, achieving a resolution that resulted in the removal of light and mild descriptors from the cigarette packaging across Canada. Brent holds a bachelor's degree in economics and political science from Carleton University and a master's of arts in economics from the University of Ottawa. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Brent. Thanks very much for being here.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here.
So can you explain what the Competition Bureau does?
The Competition Bureau is the antitrust authority for Canada, and so we look at various competition issues as well as consumer issues. On the antitrust side, we review mergers to determine whether there'd be a lessening of competition. We also look at criminal conspiracies such as price fixing and bid rigging. But as it relates to the fair business practices side, what we do is we look at misleading advertising and deceptive pricing practices and deceptive practices in order to ensure that representations regarding any type of product or service are actually true.
So what's the Bureau's role in health fraud specifically?
Well, health fraud, we enforce the Competition Act. And in enforcing the Competition Act, there's certain provisions under the misleading advertising provisions of the Act. And what that says is that if you're making a representation, it has to be based upon adequate and proper tests. And when you think about the area of health fraud, which basically can include fraudulent cure-all products that promise quick cures and easy solutions to a variety of problems, and they can be from obesity to diabetes to cancer. So any product that claims to be a miracle cure may be a fraud, and it can cheat you not only out of your time and money, but most importantly, your health.
Right. So what are some of the things that would fall into the health fraud category?
Well, I can talk to you about certain initiatives that we've taken in the past. We've been looking, concentrating on the health fraud area since around 2004, and we've had campaigns that targeted weight loss fraud, and then we went on to diabetes fraud, and most recently, we've been involved in a campaign called Project False Hope, which targets misleading cancer fraud. And we're doing that by a combination of both an enforcement program going after fraudulent marketers of cancer cures and treatments, and as well as an outreach and education program, and that is providing Canadians with the tools and the tips necessary in order to recognize this type of fraud and hopefully to stop from becoming defrauded.
Perfect. And I'm going to I'm going to want to talk about Project False Hope quite a bit later. Can you explain to the audience what makes something misleading as opposed to an outright health fraud?
Okay. Well, we do have both civil and criminal provisions under the Competition Act. And with respect to the civil provisions, if a product claim is made that is false or misleading and it's not based upon adequate and proper tests, that's a problem under the Act. So if you're making a claim, if you're saying that your pill or your lotion can treat or cure cancer, then you better be able to back that up with some tests that show that. And, you know, that's really the crux of the problem with health fraud, is that there's this asymmetric information advantage on behalf of those people that market these products.
Right.
Consumers generally don't know what a product is based upon, so they have to go on the goodwill of whatever the representation is made. So that's why people are particularly vulnerable in this area. Now, the difference between the civil and the criminal is if these individuals or firms that market these products do so knowingly and recklessly. That brings it into the criminal realm of things.
Okay. Now, the Competition Act says that authorized health products will display either an 8-digit drug identification number, a natural product number, or a homeopathic medicine number on the label. This authorization indicates that the products have been assessed by Health Canada for safety, effectiveness, and quality. So does the Competition Bureau have any say into the standards for that safety?
Well, first, did you mean you're talking about the Health Act, not the Competition Act?
Okay.
Yeah, because we deal with the Competition Act. What you're talking about is related to Health Canada.
Okay.
Yeah, but we do, because we have provisions that relate to false and misleading advertising, we're able to look at health products and services as well.
Right, but do you actually have any say into what the standards are?
No, we are not a regulator. We're
okay.
We're a federal law enforcement agency.
Right.
So really what we're doing is identifying and trying to correct market distortions where they exist and where there's a potentially misleading advertising.
Right. What I'm doing is setting the stage here. So you can only pursue actions according to what Health Canada deems the standard.
No.
Okay.
Let me give you an example here.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with the Sonobelt?
I am.
Okay. Well, Sonobelt is a matter that we took back, and we announced it back in 2008. And the Sonobelt, obviously, a lot of people saw it on infomercials, and they were making claims of being able to melt away fat and cellulite, resulting in a significant and effortless weight loss. Well, you know, we looked into that, and we arrived at an agreement with Sonobelt. In our view, it was false and misleading. And as per the agreement, the Northern Response, who was the people that were marketing the belt, had to pay $400,000 in penalties and costs, and also to offer full refunds to the to consumers.
Right. So, now, is that a fairly typical penalty?
No. In fact, that penalty itself with the Sonobelt, that I believe was one of the largest penalties, if not the largest penalty, under the provisions as they relate to false and misleading representations with performance claims. And when I say performance claims, it's where they have to be based on adequate and proper tests.
Right.
And I think, you know, one of the things that you're asked before is, you know, in terms of standards. Well, when we, and I can talk about investigations in general, when we do conduct investigations, there's various ways that you can proceed. But often in investigations, we will seek the expertise of experts in the field in order to determine whether, and to, you know, to evaluate product claims and to determine whether the product or the service actually does what it says it does.
Okay. Now, I know that a lot of people are probably planning to call in and ask questions about homeopathy. Do you or would you not be able to answer the question, you know, but homeopathy hasn't shown its effectiveness in randomized, peer-reviewed studies beyond the level of a placebo. So why are they allowed to market themselves? Would you be able to answer that at all, or is that related to you?
No.
Right.
What we do is we respond, you know, we will look at a product or we our representations on a case-by-case basis. So, you know, whether it's in various different fields, if there, you know, if there is a concern, if we're looking at the product, we have a concern with respect to the representations, then we may choose to proceed. I wouldn't say that we would. We, as I said, we're not a regulator, so we wouldn't pronounce on certain fields in general.
Right. And that's what I want to get across, just to circumvent a lot of those phone calls that are going to come in. So, but the standards that you go by apply to anything that promotes any kind of health claim.
Yes, and the false and misleading provisions, they also relate to, you know, obviously not just health fraud, but products in general. But yes, you know, related to health claims. If you're making a health claim, if you're making representation that your diet patch can lead you to lose 10 pounds in 3 days, then you better be able to back it up with some tests, because it's very persuasive, that type of advertising. And it's not just representations, by the way, written. It can be oral representations. It can be representations on infomercials, and as well, it can actually be visual clues as well. For example, we do have a teaser site. We call it a teaser site that we developed with the Federal Trade Commission in the U.S. And what it does is, when people land on it, they see a claim or they see a representation, a website where you have claims about this amazing fat foe, this eggplant extract, where you can lose weight, and then it has on representations on the side of the website. You'll find a picture of a doctor with a stethoscope around it, and as well testimonials. So all these amazing claims. So you have the written representations, you have the testimonials, and you have the visual doctor. And as soon as you go to click on one of those sites and click on to try to purchase the product, what happens is you get a warning from the Competition Bureau and the FTC saying, hey, this is exactly the type of site that is trying to defraud you of your money and your health.
Right. So tell me if you would cover this area. If it was found that an herbal or homeopathic remedy that was marketed as all natural had actual medicine in it, would that fall into your domain?
Well, we don't do evaluations without having a look at the actual product and the representation. So I can't give you an on-the-spot analysis. We really would have to take a look at the representations, determine whether the representations are material. And when I mean material, I mean representations that will lead consumers to make a purchase of a product, and then evaluate whether, again, they're based on adequate or and proper tests.
Now, how does the Competition Bureau decide what cases to investigate then?
Well, there can be.
Do you pursue that on your own, or do you wait for complaints?
There's various different ways we can come about it. Often we receive complaints, and we often commence investigations as a result of complaints. But in addition to that, what can happen is we take a look at the markets and determine what is the greatest risk. For example, with Project False Hope, what we did is we, and this was the cancer fraud campaign that we started last year, is we did an intelligence report in terms of taking a look at different risks to consumers. And we found that with respect to cancer fraud, it was right up there in terms of the risks. And so to that extent, we decided that we were going to focus on that and focus on cancer fraud for this campaign.
Okay, so what are the other campaigns that you're currently running?
Well, this is the most recent health fraud campaign, the Project False Hope. Prior to that, we had focused on diabetes and diabetes cure products, because as it is right now, you know, there is no cure for diabetes. So we were looking at potential products that would claim to treat or to cure diabetes. Now, what we often do is we do internet sweeps. So with a campaign, for example, the cancer fraud, we would go out on the internet and try to identify sites that are potentially problematic.
Right.
As a result of that most recent campaign, we identified approximately 100 sites that were potentially problematic. And at that point in time, if we have concerns, what we do is we ask these individuals to either correct their websites, or if it's egregious enough, to remove the website altogether. And with respect to that, we've had a 96% compliance rate. And what we do, though, is, you know, because a lot of these, you know, these sites are on the internet, they're internet sites, people can access them across the border. You know, with the internet, health fraud becomes an international problem, and that requires an international response. And that's why we often work together with our partners in the United States, including the Federal Trade Commission and the Food and Drug Administration, as well as our domestic partners such as Health Canada.
Now, you mentioned that you ask people to take it off, and you have a 96% compliance rate.
Yeah, what we may do is send letters requiring them to indicating that we have concerns with respect to potential contraventions of the Act with regarding their websites, and requesting that they remove it. And in the event that we do not get compliance, further enforcement action, including litigation and investigations, is a alternative.
Okay, you say litigation and investigation. So what's the extent of the repercussions that could happen?
Well, with the criminal provisions, there can be jail time, and as well there's substantial fines. As I said, you know, with respect to the Northern Response and the Sonnenbelt, which was a civil matter, there was a fine in the nature of $400,000. So you're looking at the substantial fines, as well as if it is pursued under the criminal regime, then that is the potential for jail time as well.
Do you often have trouble collecting those fines?
No, we don't.
Not at all?
No, we often don't have, no. With respect to the experience in health fraud, I don't recall a time where we've had a problem collecting that.
Interesting. So
it's generally part of a consent agreement, and it's called a rather than a fine, it's a monetary penalty. So often we'll look for the penalty alongside potentially costs of investigation.
Okay. So what's your success rate? Like, how many companies have received penalties, let's say, for health fraud?
Well, I can't really speak. I can't really recall exactly how many companies received penalties, but we have had consent agreements with various different companies, including cancer fraud companies that were alleged to have committed cancer fraud. In addition to weight loss products, we've had agreements with diet patches. I guess that was back in 2004, where there was an issue with the potential bogus diet patches that were out in the market. As well, back in 2004, we were also looking at concerns with toning and weight loss as it related to Ab Energizer and the Abtronic. I don't know if you remember that, but the Ab Energizer, it was these belts, an electronic muscle stimulation device. And it was purported to tone you and stimulate your muscles.
Right.
And with that, there was a penalty of approximately
$75,000. Okay, so what percentage of the total sales of that product do you think that that $75,000 is?
Well, I wouldn't have the I wouldn't have the answer to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm it seems like maybe there's not much of an incentive sometimes for businesses to avoid, you know, misleading statements if they're going to make more money than they would pay in a fine.
Right. Well, we, as I said, we have had success. If you look at our sweeps, where we do indicate that there are repercussions with respect to contraventions of the Act, we've had very good success with compliance, immediate compliance, which I think indicates that that these individuals, these marketers that are marketing these products, do feel that there is a potential risk with respect to maintaining the marketing of this product when they have the Bureau's attention.
Okay. Maybe give me an example of what a website would say at the start and then what you would require it be changed to. I'm just wondering the levels here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I, in order to answer this question, it's probably good to talk about things that consumers should look for when they're evaluating a website and when they're evaluating whether to purchase a product. First of all, you know, you really want to be aware of ads that promise too much.
Mm-hmm.
And as well, you know, steer clear of products that claim to be a scientific breakthrough, like genuine scientific discoveries. They make front page news. If the first and the only place that you learn about a new treatment is on the internet, then you should be suspicious. You should be skeptical. As well, you really have to keep your guard up when ads, you know, mention success stories or so-called patient testimonials. Despite what the company claims, there's really no guarantee that, you know, John Doe of Belleville, Ontario, has really achieved the results, the advertised results, or even is the real person. And a money-back guarantee, that's no proof that a product works. Scam artists who offer a guarantee have been known to just take the money and run.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And as I said, we do have these teaser sites that where consumers can go on the Competition Bureau website and see exactly what type of site would market these fraudulent products. We also have a, as part of Project False Hope, we have some education materials called The Anatomy of an Online Scam. And what happens with the anatomy on the online scam, you can go on and you can kind of see these tips in action. So it kind of tells you, tells the consumer exactly how to recognize that they're being scammed. And this education is really, really important because, you know, aside from the enforcement that we do, when we educate consumers, what we're doing is really enlisting them in the fight against fraud. And at the same time, you're increasing the costs to the fraudster because you're decreasing the potential victim pool because less people are susceptible to being defrauded by this. You know, we had, in the past, we have believed, for example, weight loss fraud. When we looked at weight loss fraud, we found that there may have not been a lot of complaints. And a lot of that is because of the vulnerable nature of consumers in that area. There could be individuals that will try a alleged weight loss product, and once it fails, they're either too ashamed to report it or they just feel that it's their fault. So a lot of times, health fraud goes unreported.
So maybe give me an example. So if a website said something about, you know, you will lose 10 pounds per day on this miracle weight loss treatment, and of course that would be misleading, and then you went in and you asked them to change it, what would you ask them to change it to? Like, what I'm asking is, what is the most that they can promise without it being considered misleading?
Well, I think the advice that we give on our teaser site about weight loss products is that claims such as lose weight without any effort, lose weight overnight, lose weight and keep it off, lose weight without exercise, you know, there's really only one way to lose weight, and that includes, you know, that includes exercise regimen and relating to caloric intake. So any kind of claims that allude to the fact that you can lose 10 pounds in 3 days and losing it while you're sleeping, losing it without any effort, eat whatever you want and lose 10 pounds in a week, those are potentially misleading.
Okay, so for example, something, what about something with subjective symptoms? So for example, this product, this herbal product will, you know, eliminate your headaches. And then, let's say, I buy the herbal product that turns out not to eliminate my headaches. Now, is that considered health fraud?
Well, yeah, again, we'd have to consider the product. We'd have to look at the representation. And in certain instances, we would need to determine whether it was based on adequate and proper tests.
So what are adequate and proper tests then?
Adequate and proper tests, when we conduct an investigation, mm-hmm. we will request tests. Like I said, often we will seek the advice of expertise in order to determine whether the tests do support the performance claims that are made. Now, this provision that performance claims and representations have to be made on based on adequate and proper tests, mm-hmm. it's a reverse onus provision, which means that the company has to have the tests available.
Okay. If I had a problem with that aforementioned herbal remedy, is there a number that I could call that would start this complaint process going? Like, how does an individual get their case heard?
Yeah, well, if an individual, and regardless of the health product, if an individual has a concern relating to a product, then they most certainly can call the Competition Bureau and place a complaint with the Bureau.
Okay. So tell us about some of the international investigations that you've been involved in.
Well, With respect to the international campaigns, the Project False Hope is the most obvious at this point in time, the most recent. And again, that's where we would take a coordinated approach, looking at fraudulent cancer cure websites, not only us but also our partners in the U.S. And by that, you know, obviously we may share information in order to identify sites that are either based in Canada or based in the U.S. You see, you know, when I talk about internet fraud being an international problem, you know, you can often have, you may have a company that's operating in one country and then targeting victims and targeting consumers in another country with money going somewhere else. So that's why, you know, you have to have an international response in order to kind of combat that. And as well, if a company in Canada, for example, gets a notification and is contacted by not only Canadian authorities, but authorities in the U.S., it really sends the message to these people that there's no place to hide. It's not that they can jump the border and set up a shop in another area.
Okay, so is it possible for a business to lose their license altogether?
To lose their license, like I said, we're not a regulatory authority, but so what we do is just enforce the act. If we see an issue with a company and with the representations, then that's what we would focus on, and that's what our provisions are focused on, is to determine whether representations are made that are false or misleading. Okay. And in that sense, you know, we may arrive at consent agreements and agreements with companies that require them to cease making such representations. It may require them to pay, as I indicated, an administrative monetary penalty. It may require them to provide product refunds to consumers.
I think one of the problems with this is I'm not getting a clear sense of, you know, it's very easy to understand when someone says, this will cure your cancer. That's definitely not going to happen. But it seems like there's a really fuzzy line between what's considered misleading.
A fuzzy line in what sense?
Well, and I understand it depends on the situation, but it seems like a lot of products can say things that are very vague and draw allusions to health benefits.
Oh, I see what
without
you're
actually outright saying it.
Okay, well, that's where, you know, when we're looking at a product, we're not only looking at the literal meaning of the representation, but also the general impression. Okay? So, to that extent, the general impression of a product or a representation could include what they say. It could include pictorials, and it can include looking at a combination of what is said on the website. So, you really have to take all those factors into consideration and evaluate them to determine whether the general impression of a representation is false or misleading.
Okay. So, for example, let's go back to the weight loss website. A website that has an image of an overweight person that says before, and then an image of a thinner person right beside it. And it looks like maybe there's two different skin tones. They're probably different people. Would that be considered misleading?
That in and of itself?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you'd really have to determine. That might be part of the representation that indicates whether that tries to convey that a product will lead to weight loss, but you'd have to look at other factors as well, including the statements, and as well you'd have to evaluate whether a product or services has representations, or sorry, has tests in order to back up whatever their claims are. You'd have to look at everything in conjunction with each other.
Okay, and we have a couple of questions that were submitted before the episode. Go ahead, Ryan.
Let's say that the CCB successfully regulates or finds the company out of existence. What happens to the guy behind that company? Does he escape, free to start up a new health scam?
Sorry, and the CCB?
Sorry, the Canadian Competition Bureau, I assume. And just to add to that, can they start it up in another country?
Can they start it? Oh, so I, the way that I understand the question, if we have an agreement, if we have a problem with the company and we resolve it, or if there's an order by the tribunal or a court, can they start it up again?
That's how I would take the question. Could they in effect not follow your request? Could they leave that company and start up a new company. Is there any way to know that?
Well, generally, if it's the same company, first of all, if it's the same company that has an agreement with the Bureau, and as part of the agreement they're to cease from making representations in contravention of the Act, and then they go about and do that, then that's and that's a violation of the agreement itself. So we would be able to kind of address that way. Now, in terms of going to another country, you know, there's other countries that have their own consumer kind of protection legislation. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that somebody goes to another country and they start to conduct the same scheme, then they could fall afoul of the legislation of that country.
All right. There's another website question.
Other organizations in favor of health fraud and all its delicious money that actively fight the CCB. Can we name some names?
I don't think, I think what the person is trying to say is not that are actively pro-health fraud, but are trying to actively resist the changes that you're trying to make.
That actively resist the changes that, well, you mean against the ability for us to kind of enforce the Act as it relates to health fraud?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of organizations, none come to mind. Generally, Canadians are often very supportive of the actions that are taken in order to combat misleading health fraud. As you know, with consumers and Canadians are more and more looking to the Internet for health information. I think a recent study said that 8.7 million Canadians turn to the Internet in order to gauge information on health. So it's really important for them to ensure that they get accurate information. And so I've seen general support for these type of actions.
Okay. Now let's talk more about Project False Hope.
Okay.
So that's a very specific campaign, and it's cancer-focused. And actually, I believe it was in February of this year, there was an Edmonton-based company that made some cancer-related claims.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that one, the Bioenergy Wellness?
Yes, I think it's yes. And it was carrying on business, I believe, as the Energy Works Wellness Center.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And, you know, with these claims, again, what happened here is that we arrived at a consent agreement with this company with regard to our allegations of unproven claims that their product can cure cancer. And what we had here in terms of the products that were involved is this company advertised the sale and promotion of something called the Papany, the MagnaPulse, and far infrared sauna treatment devices, as well as some cancer and treatment prevention sessions that would be carried out at their Energy Works Wellness Center in Edmonton. So when after an investigation, the Bureau concluded that these cancer-related performance claims were not based on adequate and proper tests as required by the provisions of the Act. And really, you know, as we see it, you know, cancer is a very serious illness, and companies shouldn't expose consumers to unproven health claims because they can really cheat them out of their time and their money. So, yeah, we did that. That is one of the cases that did emerge from Project False Hope.
Mm-hmm.
And that said, there are other investigations ongoing.
So, again, was that from an individual complaint, or is that something you guys pursued?
Mm. In terms of the specific genesis of the of this, it could very well have been through the internet surveillance that was conducted.
All right. So, what do you remember? What their original website said? Did it say it would cure cancer?
Well, there were claims and unproven claims that products could cure and address cancer, as well as these sessions and prevention sessions at this at the Energy Wellness Center. Yeah.
Okay, so I just want to make sure I understand this. So, a company can say that they will cure and treat cancer, and they can do that for, let's say, years. And then you'll find them, and you ask them to take it off the website. And if they agree, that's the end of the story?
Well, this is an example where we, through an investigation, and we came to an agreement with this company. But often, when it comes to health fraud, and this could be weight loss fraud, it could be diabetes, and it could be the recent cancer, the benefit of carrying out these internet sweeps and trying to get, once we identify sites, to get them removed as soon as possible, you know, there's potential dangers when there's health fraud out there. So to the extent that we can get the removal of sites on an expedited basis, you know, it saves time, money, and at the same time, it helps to protect consumers.
Right. So what about the people that in the years before had gone to those wellness centers or used those medications or, well, not medications, remedies and such? What kind of do they get compensation? Are they entitled to pursue action of their own?
Well, with respect to certain agreements that we've had, and it can vary from agreement to agreement. For example, with Northern Response, with the sauna belt, consumers who purchased the sauna belt could obtain a refund. And so as part of certain agreements, we will try to seek refunds for the individuals.
Okay, what if let's say they had resulting medical concerns after that? What would you suggest they do?
Well, you know, as an antitrust authority, if they have resulting medical concerns, we wouldn't really kind of comment on that. We would just basically look at the antitrust and the antitrust aspect of it.
Right.
If there's medical concerns, I would say that the individual would probably be good to talk to a professional and a lawyer in order to determine whether there's anything that can be, any reparations that could be made.
Perfect. We have someone in the chat room with a question.
Yes, K.O. Myers from Grassroots Skeptics asks from the chat room, will your agency only investigate claims made by consumers who've actually purchased the product, or can you pursue claims reported by skeptics who haven't been personally misled?
Oh, you don't have to have purchased a product in order for us to look at a complaint. So if individuals have complaints with respect to potentially misleading websites or misleading products or misleading services, they can most certainly lodge a complaint with the Competition Bureau.
So this is something that you might offer as a community service activity to skeptical groups. If a bunch of people wanted to get together and search the internet for a day and send you a big list of potentially misleading websites, that would be encouraged?
Well, if individuals identify potential problems with or areas of concerns, then we'd be more than happy to receive complaints.
Okay, what kind of time period are we looking at from the time that somebody complains to the time that should the website actually be seen as misleading that the website would change?
Yeah, that really does vary on a case by case basis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with respect to Project False Hope, The first step was to conduct the internet sweep, but obviously you also have to there's analysis involved, and if a product or service or a firm is determined to have, if there's concerns that they have conducted themselves in a false and misleading manner, then there can be an investigation, and that can take time. So there's no real set time period.
Okay. How many investigations would you say you've done? In regards to health fraud?
Investigations. I can't really comment on ongoing investigations. Obviously, we have done quite a few investigations. We've done investigations into the, you know, with, you identified the Energy Works. We've looked at unproven weight loss claims with respect to Northern Response, and as well with diet patches. We've also looked at, in the area of health fraud, the belts relating to the muscle stimulus belts with the Ab Energizer and the Abtronic. And these are just cases that resulted in consent agreements and resulted in agreements. There's also obviously investigations that may be ongoing that, of course, we can't comment on.
Okay. Would you consider that there's a lot of obstacles to actually taking action on health fraud on the internet specifically?
Well, for us, when, as I said, when we look at a matter, you know, first off, we have to determine the representation and whether it is material, whether it's whether it will influence a consumer in order to purchase the product. Again, we've conducted investigations and using expertise. So in terms of obstacles, we really, I wouldn't say that there's a serious obstacle. The only obstacles, of course, being limited resources and unlimited demands on those resources. Obviously, we have to pick and choose those areas that we believe to be of most risk to consumers. And that's why we had to determine, you know, we will set priorities in health fraud. We will set priorities, for example, with Project False Hope, the cancer fraud a few years back, looking at diabetes, and behind that as well, the weight loss fraud. Often that's what we do, is we try to concentrate on a specific area that we believe poses a risk to consumers.
Okay. Another listener question from the website.
Yes, Anxious Medic asks from the chat room, do they release the judgments of the Bureau online?
Oh, yes. Well, if once an agreement is made with the Competition Bureau and a party, then what will happen is that agreement, if it's a consent agreement, it can be registered with the Competition Tribunal. So anybody can go online to the Competition Tribunal and take a look at those agreements. And in those agreements, it will tell you the terms of the agreement as well as often the concerns of the Bureau within that full agreement.
And all of the agreements are listed online?
For consent agreements, they would be listed online, yes.
What wouldn't you list online?
What wouldn't be listed online? Well, investigations that are ongoing. If an investigation is ongoing, then clearly it wouldn't be listed at the tribunal website until it's concluded. But often, as well, what we will do is, even if we have an agreement with a company that's not even registered, if a company agrees to undertake to take corrective action, then we will often issue a press release. We believe that it's important in order to promote compliance amongst the industry for us to get out there and send the message and say, hey, you know, this is what's happened. So to the greatest extent possible, when we conclude an agreement where we have a resolution where parties have agreed to stop behavior, then we will issue a press release.
All right. Has any company ever said no to changing their website and decided to take it down instead?
Oh, you mean and decided to take it down instead?
Mm-hmm. The website down.
And just remove the website?
Yep.
Well, depending on the concerns with the company, as I said, when we're looking at the internet, then we may, if we have only have concerns with certain representations, we may suggest that we have that those be removed, and often we may say that, well, we would suggest that the whole website is removed. So it's at that point, it's really up to the business how they want to address the Bureau's concerns.
Okay, and we have one last question.
We can make it so that fake medicine has to follow strict advertising rules and not make any specific medical claims, but how do you regulate it when it just says promotes wellness or boosts immune system? Is there anything that can be done?
Okay. Well, again, first of all, we're not a regulator. You know, we're a law enforcement agency. And with regard to claims, generally we focus on the most egregious claims, such as, you know, in the area of cancer fraud, curing Schedule A diseases like diabetes and cancer. With respect to general wellness claims, again, what we would have to do is take a look at the claims and determine the level of egregiousness and whether they're based on adequate and proper tests. There may be products that that do live up to what their claims say.
Okay, and I think we are out of time for today. Thanks very much to Brent Homan from the Canadian Competition Bureau for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And you can find out more about health fraud at competitionbureau.gc.ca/health fraud. And although we didn't get to touch on it too much, the interactive portion of the websites for Project False Hope, actually, that Brent was talking about, look at the icons on the right-hand side of the page. They're very well done, and you can pass them on to your more credulous friends and relatives. And as always, you can visit skepticallyspeaking.com to comment on the episode and to find links to our Facebook group, Twitter feed, and subscribe in iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Next week on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking to Nicky Garrett, guitarist in the legendary punk rock band The UK Subs. He also happens to be an active skeptic. Does speaking out against pseudoscience, magical thinking, and unexamined beliefs get in the way of damning the man? And by popular demand, we'll introduce our new semi-regular segment, Ask a Pharmacist with Scott Guevara, answering all the questions you'd ask your own pharmacist if the line wasn't so long. All this and more on the next Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, here on CJSR.
Married. I'm dating your sister, and everything you believe is a lie.